This is a CNA podcast.
Countries all around the world have moved at warp speed to roll out a COVID vaccine and get shots in arms. Little effort has been spared to convince people and make sure the vaccine is safe for more, including pregnant moms, teenagers, and the immunocompromised. And in Singapore, authorities have pulled all stops to get a jab as easy as possible, with walk-in clinics and mobile teams supported by volunteer doctors offering vaccination at home. But months on, many developed nations are hitting a plateau, despite clear evidence that vaccinations protect people from severe disease and death. Meanwhile, the Delta variant is tearing through the world, driving up infections and threatening a new wave of lockdowns. So we have to ask a tough question squarely now. Is it time to shift from persuasion and consider more aggressive action to get vaccination rates up? Should there be penalties for those without legitimate medical reasons? This is Heart of the Matter. It's Thursday, 8:15 a.m. And with me to discuss vaccination rates are David Lai, Director of the Infectious Disease Research and Training Office at NCID.
Hello, I'm David.
And Ashley St. John, Associate Professor at Duke NUS Medical School's Program in Emerging Infectious Disease.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Ashley, maybe get us started. When we look at the situation in Singapore, the vaccination rates are quite high. First dose, 84%. And that's even past the elusive 80% targets that were set last year that should have allowed for herd immunity and some semblance of normalcy. Those targets were set by the Health Ministry's Chief Health Scientist, Dr. Tan Chor Chuan. But yet every time the multi-ministry speaks, the message is always one of caution and not easing too quickly when many aren't vaccinated. So my first question to you is, what's the danger that you're seeing with these hundreds of thousands not vaccinated that can be reduced significantly if they get the jab? And would getting that marginal number of people vaccinated really mitigate these risks?
It's important to start with the good news. The good news is we've reached above this 80% target, which is phenomenal. It's one of the leading rates of vaccination in the world, and it's certainly going to protect people. We can start to see that more than 90% of the severe disease is unvaccinated, even as there have been increased levels of infection. And those who've been vaccinated often have asymptomatic disease that's just detected with these really highly sensitive tests. That's what we're expecting to see with vaccination, and we are seeing it, and that's really good news. In terms of why we might be worried, we do need to try to understand why the remaining people who haven't been vaccinated, why haven't they been vaccinated, and can we get them their vaccines so that they can be better protected?
I just want to stay on the topic before we get into why people are not getting vaccinated. So David, vaccination has often talked to benefit individuals, like Ashley mentioned, less chance of severe disease and death. But the Delta variant is also shining a spotlight on how the unvaccinated could affect the lives of the vaccinated. It's also businesses' livelihoods impacted if restrictions must be pulled to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system. And we've seen the number of cases skyrocket in the last couple of days. Is there a stronger urgent case now that getting as many people vaccinated as possible is in the public interest?
Certainly. The key things at the moment is to make sure that we don't have too many people who need oxygen, too many people in the intensive care unit. As of last night, there were about 73 people who needed oxygen.
Wow.
The same in the UK, US, Israel. More than 95% of these sick people are unvaccinated. Even among the vaccinated people in Singapore who caught COVID, they're actually very mild. And the few that require oxygen require just a little bit of oxygen, and they got better very quickly. Is that 12% unvaccinated who are eligible that we really need to work on? More importantly, it is the unvaccinated among the 60s and above, because a younger person who's unvaccinated may not end up in ICU, but an older person in their 70s and 80s unvaccinated and catch COVID have a high chance of ending up in intensive care. And that will strain up a healthcare system. It will affect people who need to access intensive care, for example, for surgery or with heart attack and stroke.
When we think about getting people vaccinated, we also are looking to the possibility of retaining some level of normalcy, moving towards living with COVID. So if we get that 12% vaccinated, do you think we can relax restrictions? And what is the new target then for vaccination rates such that Singapore can cross into the next stage to transition towards endemic living?
We've been talking about vaccination targets since last year. first with this concept of herd immunity. But to be honest, there is no herd immunity with Delta because it's highly transmissible. And with the current vaccines as well, none of them provide what we call sterilizing immunity. That means you can still get infected if vaccinated, but you have a very mild disease. So the key thing here currently is not whether it is 85 or 90%, is to get as many people who are willing to get vaccinated, vaccinated. And for those who don't want to get vaccinated, they need to be told what will happen to them if they get infected. And that's why it's very useful that we start seeing publicly released data from Israel, from US, and over the weekend from Singapore, that shows that if you are unvaccinated compared to is vaccinated, and both groups catch COVID, the risk of severe disease in ICU and death is about 10 to 15 times more. Now, you can wait for 10 years for the side effects of the vaccines to manifest itself. But in the meantime, you put yourself and your parents at great risk of ending up in ICU with the Delta variant.
Ashley, when you're looking at cases around the world, and indeed the time is needed for the emergence of data to show the drawbacks of not getting vaccinated, with the passage of time, peer pressure also can be a powerful motivating force when vaccines have been positioned as a choice. Looking at all this across the world, in the US where you are as well right now, how confident are you that moral suasion, the evidence of benefits and pressure from the majority can tilt the balance to get the remaining vaccinated?
Many of the people who are unvaccinated, they either perhaps have access issues or something that can be pretty quickly solved, or in some cases, they're hesitant to take the vaccine. And I think it's important to really convey this message to the public of how safe the vaccines are, although they do have some mild side effects, particularly something like an injection site reaction or a day where you might feel tired. Those are all really signs of your immune system working. The signs of your immune system working can be uncomfortable, but they're much, much better than getting COVID or spreading COVID to your close family members. So I think that this is a message that we need to be able to convey to people in a respectful way. And I think we have evidence that the vaccines are extraordinarily safe. They're safe in even children, according to the recent clinical trials. And this is something that we can use to protect the community from COVID-19. So that information, the correct information that is evidence-based and based on data and public health studies, this needs to be conveyed so that people can make the appropriate choice, because really the best choice is always to get vaccinated in this case.
But Ashley, when first shot vaccination rates are plateauing and the numbers are not increasing anymore, how long more do you think this continuation of a strategy to convince people will work? And do we have enough time?
I agree with David in the sense that if someone is not willing to be vaccinated, I think it's important just that they understand the risk that they are taking themselves and the consequences of severe COVID. The consequences, death, and also potentially really severe disease that can be painful and life-changing even after survival. So those are the concepts that people should understand. And if they still choose to not be vaccinated, that's very unfortunate. And we should continue to think of ways to reach out to them and to communicate to them the benefits of vaccination and the science behind vaccination so that people are making choices with the appropriate information. Perhaps there is a certain percentage of the population that may still not want to be vaccinated, and there are certainly some that cannot for certain reasons. They may have particular pre-existing conditions that don't allow them to be vaccinated. We have to think also of trying to protect those people by achieving the highest levels of vaccination possible in our community.
So David, just zooming in here, Singapore is arguably already one of the world's most vaccinated countries. We've done everything we can to get people vaccinated. We've ensured that it's safe for everyone eligible, the pregnant, even teenagers. And we've done everything we can to make vaccination accessible. There's walk-in vaccination centers and home vaccination teams to reach the e-mobile. And yet, out of the remaining unvaccinated, apart from those that are not able to get it because of medical reasons and young children for which the shot has not been approved yet, there are about 200,000 to 300,000 unvaccinated adults. My question is, have you come across people who refuse the vaccine without good medical grounds, and what's holding them back?
I've gained some insight from when I conduct public webinars to verify these issues. There are several broad groups. Pregnancy comes up very frequently.
Even if it's safe now?
Exactly. Pregnant mothers, as well as parents in general are concerned about effect on the babies. And so it requires a lot of explanation that with a large body of evidence now, there's no increased risk to the babies and it protects the mother as well as the baby if they get COVID. The other thing that a lot of people ask is if they have medical problems, will they be okay to take? A lot of people perceive having chronic medical conditions like diabetes and blood pressure to make them frail. But these are exactly the conditions that put them at risk of bad COVID and they could benefit from vaccination. So this really highlights that we probably haven't communicated well enough publicly. We know about communication with patients. Even if we tell them everything in lay language, in general, about a third or less will register the information. So when you communicate publicly, I think it's even harder. We continue to have a lot of webinars where people can ask questions, we can answer the question directly. And a third group really is about children of vulnerable elderly who are concerned about their frail parents getting a bad outcome after vaccination. And this is partly triggered by a lot of stories in the social media, in those chat groups like Telegram, where people tell unverified horror stories about vaccinations. I often tell them, you don't know any of these people. They're anonymous online as far as we can tell. But why do you trust them instead of the government, WHO, and US CDC, and so on? Because they're not responsible for your hospitalization or death if you catch COVID. These are valid concerns. These are not people who are anti-vaccines. They are just vaccine hesitants. And what we can do with them is more effective public communication. Sometimes it's not just a general message. You may have to deal with the individuals. And that's why currently we're asking all doctors to speak to their patients who are unvaccinated. And I do that myself in my clinic every week.
But just a quick question to both of you. Isn't it very frustrating as infectious disease experts studying the science, knowing how safe this is, how efficient it is? We have a vaccine that's effective and no cost to people to take it to solve a raging pandemic. And yet it seems like a lot of the hesitancy is borne out by misinformation or a misunderstanding.
Certainly, but frustration doesn't get you anywhere. I was obviously quite actively involved in trying to combat misinformation online. But I realized while these people are there for whatever motives that they have to dissuade people from getting vaccinated, we do have to get to the people who need the vaccination. That's why we need everyone. It's not the doctors and scientists like Ashley and myself. It is the doctors and the nurses in the clinics, on the ground, grassroots, volunteers, to speak to people. In fact, one of the things I say these days is, don't just say hello, good morning to your neighbors or your friends. Follow that with, have you been vaccinated? And start a conversation.
I certainly agree. This is frustrating, but I agree that frustration doesn't help in this sense. We have to take the time and invest the effort in connecting with people and explaining to them. We have a lot of knowledge, and it doesn't help to just say what should be done. It actually helps to explain what's happening when you have a vaccine, why it's safe, what you can expect in either case. And this is something that interestingly comes up every year with my students in class at Duke and US. We talk about vaccines and how they work. And I inevitably always get a member of the class speaking up and wanting to discuss how to talk about vaccine hesitancy with their family members and friends. This is something that we need tools, we need discussion, we need the webinars, we need outreach. And especially it happens at a community level where each person who takes the time to decide to go with evidence-based beliefs rather than anecdotal beliefs, you know, thinks of how to communicate to those around them and reach out to them and explain these basic ways that vaccines work.
We've known everything already, and the science is clear. You know, the WHO advises mandatory vaccination only be justified for highly contagious, serious diseases with established vaccine safety and efficacy. It sounds like these are boxes that the COVID vaccine checks. So what's stopping us from, say, simply mandating vaccinations, David? Doesn't the COVID vaccine qualify under these guidelines from the WHO?
Some of the reasons given for not mandating is full authorization. And that's why US FDA proceeded with full approval of the Pfizer vaccine and with Moderna following suit soon. It's a question of what can you do with vaccine mandate? Because even if you have a vaccine mandate and if a person refuses to turn up in the vaccination center, what do you do? You can't exactly turn up at your house and say, I need to give you a check, right? Ultimately, I think the vaccine different strategies are what will nudge people But at the same time, it is very important to remember that there are certain essential services that a society really should have guaranteed access to, such as healthcare and public transport. You can't exactly say, if you're not vaccinated, you can't come to the hospital or you can't take public transport. But you can say that to work in a company, you have to be vaccinated. That respects rights, taking into account public good.
But David, the government has rules for employers to test their workers if they're not vaccinated. And people in high-risk settings, people in healthcare, aviation, they do have to have a regular regime of testing if they're not vaccinated too, though.
That is supposed to nudge people to vaccinate, right? So if you don't get vaccinated, you have to swab yourself so frequently that it becomes inconvenient and you have to bear your own cost. I think the next step is to say that these are critical jobs and industry. We can't afford to have people getting infected and therefore you need to be vaccinated. It's not a universal vaccine mandate, but it's a bit similar to what the US seems to have said, all federal employees need to be vaccinated. And that is fine. And it is pragmatic. If you still object to the vaccine, well, you can find a new job. One has to bear in mind that the COVID pandemic has a great impact on people's job security. While some of us clamor for that, it's also important that if you make that a vaccine mandate, that you have to vaccinate to get a job, then some people will have difficulty sustaining their livelihood.
But there's a middle ground, right? Because there's a possibility of limited mandates, making it compulsory for high-risk roles to get the jab. And if you don't get the jab, then you can't be in that front-facing roles, whether it's OH homes, because we don't want people and residents there to get infected, healthcare, aviation workers. And those that do not get that can surely move those workers into another position when they're not front-facing. Countries like Australia, the UK and Greece have even mandated vaccination for those kinds of roles specifically. Don't you think that's something Singapore can approach?
I'm sure the government has considered that. At the moment, what we say in hospital is you need to be vaccinated in frontline roles. Mm-hmm. And we try our very best. You know, we don't just accept the first word. We keep going back to the same employee who refuses to vaccinate again and again. Mm. And we've seen that slowly improving. I can't speak for the government. From the science perspective, I think it makes perfect sense. But from the policy perspective, there are a lot more considerations.
Staying on businesses though, because businesses suffer the brunt of any infections that break out, shouldn't employers be responsible for keeping their people safe, their customers safe, and be given the power to mandate vaccination in certain roles?
If you think about what has been agreed upon between the Tripartite Alliance, I think they did say that employers can make certain job roles subject to vaccination, but they have to kind of redeploy. That can be very difficult for companies, right? Because in a small company, I mean, what can you redeploy? The current agreement among employers, government, and employees are you can't sack someone for not getting vaccinated. Workers' rights is something that is already not great in Asia, although Singapore has this tripartite alliance that's very useful. I'm all for more vaccination, but at the same time, I just want to remind my colleagues and the people that believe in vaccination that making people lose their job and suffer more than necessary in the pandemic is not necessarily the best thing one can do. I'm not sure that that is something that our society is ready for, to be honest.
So Ashley, differentiated measures among the vaccinated and the unvaccinated were actually primarily designed to keep those who are unvaccinated out of higher risk settings. And in Singapore, that means dining, concerts. But might they, as David suggests, be pushing people to get their jab? Are you seeing this happen across the world? And are these incentives huge enough to get more vaccinated?
So that's a good question. People are becoming vaccinated when their employer is mandating in other parts of the world. That's one of the factors in the US, for example, where the federal government has recently mandated vaccination for employees, and then they've seen an increase in the vaccine uptake. So some people were just not doing it for whatever reason, and then were forced to really make their decision instead of staying on the fence. Where do you really draw the line of who should be vaccinated and how firmly you consider that waiver or contraindication for vaccination? In some cases, it might not be a good idea for them to be vaccinated. At the same time, I think that some of these measures, such as
increased surveillance on the unvaccinated are a reasonable way to continue to monitor, particularly knowing that the virus is much more likely to spread in an unvaccinated portion of the population. But at the same time, we have to consider the fact that there should be an advantage for people who have chosen to be vaccinated. So I think that some of these measures of surveillance that have continued in vaccinated groups should really be tapered off slowly because they are at much lower risk of spreading the virus. And I think there should be some benefit, some motivation to transfer from this group of being unvaccinated to being vaccinated. Once you've been vaccinated, if symptomatic individuals probably should be tested for COVID, but the routine testing of vaccinated individuals, in my opinion, is a little bit kind of like overkill in some sense. And we should really focus on trying to get people vaccinated and then monitoring symptomatic infections.
So David, we're hearing Ashley say that indeed there should be a differentiation, perhaps a stronger one to nudge people a little bit more. And we know that choosing to stay unvaccinated does come with costs in terms of dollars and cents, not just because of the risk of severe disease, death, but the impact also on businesses and livelihoods. So for those who refuse vaccination without strong, justifiable reasons, is it reasonable to expect that maybe the government relooks continuing to pay for their COVID treatment if they get sick? Should they bear the cost of needed regular testing?
Actually, I think it's important to remind the public that COVID treatment has returned to our public healthcare funding model since the end of last year. We know that the government was very generous to encourage people to come forward, and for more than first 9 months of the year, it was fully paid for. But what it means is that it's still subsidized because all COVID patients are subsidized, and so the government is still paying the bulk of it. And in fact, it's not cheap. If you have got sick COVID, whether it is intensive care or whether it's all the effective medications to treat COVID, they are not cheap, they're expensive. Currently, people are paying for it, but with government subsidy. Now, whether or not we can say if you're unvaccinated, we make you pay for it, it is something that some people have been saying. But we must remember that if you create this incentive for people to come forward to seek treatment or to get tested, in public health terms, it is not great for control of the pandemic. What can happen, though, is to follow the insurance model, right? The people with higher risk, for example, if you are a smoker, you are overweight, you pay more for your insurance premium. And this can happen, although the impact is less visible. I think a lot of people may think that they don't pay for COVID treatment, but they do, and it is expensive. For the majority, for the 98% who are mild, it doesn't cost too much. But remember that if you get sick and you need oxygen and you stay in hospital and you need the treatment, it is expensive. It's something that you can avoid by taking a free vaccine. So it is something that we haven't said enough in the public.
But since the costs are high for those who catch severe disease and death, and the chances of people getting there are usually those who are unvaccinated, shouldn't they bear a greater part of that cost?
It is something very logical to most of us, but the point I'm trying to highlight is if you take that approach, it will end up discouraging people to come forward to get tested and not turning up for treatment until they are far too sick. And that will make your control of the pandemic worse. One of the reasons why Singapore does so well, if you look at the numbers of cases that we have and the age group that's affected and the mortality that we have is exceptionally low, it's because patients are detected early, monitored carefully, and treatment started early to prevent them from progressing. And if we start to say you have to pay for all your treatment, you can imagine that some people may take their chance and say, I will try to see if I can get over this. And then by the time they are in strife and end up in hospital gasping for air, they will do badly and the healthcare system will do badly. So I think it's important to remember this public health impact of some of these visceral, instinctive ideas.
Well, actually, looking at all the other countries that have created incentives and disincentives separating the unvaccinated and the vaccinated, do you have any advice on whether there are certain penalties or certain incentives that we can think about to get people to take the COVID vaccine that have worked?
I'm not so much of an expert on the policy decisions, but I think the ultimate penalty is having severe disease. And this is something that the vaccine ultimately is very sure to prevent. When we talk about miracle drugs, we talk about something that prevents disease in more than 90% of people, and that's what we have with this vaccine. It's a personal choice, but it is a penalty that is really self-inflicted if you don't take a vaccine. This ultimately is the biggest incentive, is the idea that you and your family members can be protected through just teaching your immune system how to recognize the virus. It's a very simple thing that you can do. It doesn't take very long to get a vaccine. It doesn't take very long for it to work, maybe a month in total before you can be considered fully vaccinated. It's something that is straightforward and a personal choice to protect yourself. That really is the motivation. It's like both the carrot and the stick in this case. Obviously, policymakers can implement other things that can affect, but for each person making their own decision, I think understanding how the vaccine works, that it's non-infectious, that it's just a molecule that's injected into your arm, and it's a blueprint for making the surface protein on this virus that can then teach your immune system so that it can say, ah, yes, I've seen this before. That is something that is very simple and safe according to all of the data.
Let me just try to wrap up also. I just want to go back to that idea of making COVID vaccines compulsory, because there have been so many advocates that are asking for that, and they actually point to precedent. So David, explain to us why immunization against measles and diphtheria are compulsory by law in Singapore, but not the COVID vaccine at this point.
It's quite hard to comment on policy decisions. When we say compulsory, what it means is that if you're not vaccinated against measles, you can't attend a public school.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not the government will come to that for schools, I think we have to wait for the vaccines being available to children below 12, because it's a primary school group, and also for the vaccines to be fully approved. There are still some differences. We forget that we have not done this before, vaccinating a whole nation in less than a year. Along the way, we want to do certain things that we're used to, but what we are doing currently doesn't have a precedent. I don't think measles vaccination in its time were done universally in 9 months. But to add to what Ashley said, while we currently emphasize that more than 98% of people with COVID are mild, but actually this majority of people are vaccinated, because close to 88-90% of the eligible are vaccinated. The unvaccinated do have higher proportion who are unwell. So that's number one. As more cases increase, the unvaccinated proportionately will suffer more. That's number one. Number two is, even if you have mild disease, long COVID will hang over you, because from overseas, North America and Europe, it's increasingly recognized that months after COVID, people don't feel normal. And if you want your life to be like that for the next couple of years, you can choose the virus over the vaccine. I will pick the vaccine. I'll pick the vaccine for all my family, my friends, and my colleagues.
One last question. I'm still trying to get both of you to nail down what's so bad about making the COVID vaccine compulsory. We are hearing a lot about how vaccination, making it compulsory, might earn some form of a backlash, might spur people to not come forward. It would be very difficult to enforce, cannot be compared to measles and diphtheria. Wouldn't it be worth biting that short-term bullet for the longer-term benefits, including mitigating the risk of long COVID, keeping the population safe, not having to pull more restrictions? What are your final thoughts on this? Maybe we can start with you, Ashley.
I agree with David that a key aspect was the approval previously. So FDA regulatory approval. The FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine is a strong signal that it will gain regulatory approval in other countries as well. And that might pave the way for it being reasonable. But clearly, clinical trials are done on these vaccines. It takes a long time. They monitor very carefully for any risks and side effects so that people who are making a decision can understand the risk that they are exposed to. And it's so low in the case of the COVID vaccines that it's really not a very significant concern. But I think from a public health standpoint, it's still important to wait for that regulatory approval and the due diligence and all of the scientists and doctors to evaluate all of the data. So I think that does pave the way for it being more reasonable. If you're asking me personally, it would be nice to have compulsory COVID vaccines, but I also understand that there are some limitations and there are other policy considerations that have to be evaluated that are beyond just the scientific aspects. I'm waiting to hear also what the different task forces on this think. I think I also agree with David that, you know, when you're dealing with people in these public facing positions, you do want to be interacting with people who've been vaccinated. Employers are in a good position to begin the process of trying to get those last few people vaccinated. But certainly once you have vaccination as high as it is in Singapore, you have each person who is infected infecting fewer and fewer people. And this is an important aspect of how diseases spread. How many people do you come in contact with and then can become infected? Vaccinated individuals are much less likely to spread the disease. So it may at some point really result in a situation where we don't have a high level of infection and it's low enough that it can be managed with other measures. And I'm hoping that we'll begin to see that. Certainly the mild disease is something that is occurring in vaccinated individuals, but not severe disease. Then our focus can shift from trying to achieve the highest levels of vaccination possible to trying to protect those most at risk. That could be through different measures, such as booster shots. At this time, it seems that a lot of those doses could be better used in vaccinating more people. But at some point, we'll reach a stage where we'll want to be protecting first those who are most vulnerable, who've had weak immune responses to the first two vaccines. And then we may want to be able to protect those who are vulnerable better with a booster dose rather than trying to achieve one more person vaccinated in the community. And these are all considerations that can be studied and modeled, and plans can be made for the appropriate course of action to protect the community best.
Final thoughts, David?
As a doctor involved in looking after COVID patients and also as a researcher in this area, I am in favor of a vaccine mandate. But I'm also aware that the impact on the individuals in these times can be devastating. We need to embrace some humanity. I still believe that I should persuade everyone that I can talk to take the vaccines, because having spoken to thousands of people now, the vaccine hesitant can be persuaded. To all your listeners, if you want me to talk to your social groups, I would clarify your doubts. I think it can be done. A lot of my colleagues, our doctors and nurses on the ground, are helping to get the last mile done. It's also important in this time not to be overly harsh on these people, because mental health is a major fallout from the pandemic as well.
Ashley, David, thank you very much. So there you have it. Should COVID vaccination be made mandatory, or should the unvaccinated bear the burden of catching COVID? Looks like there's a lot more behind those questions. This has been Heart of the Matter with me, Lin Su Ling, Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. Signing off until next week.